All right, I think we have a sufficient level of folks in their seats and others close enough to them that we'll begin our next panel. Does anyone still out in the hallway, please bring your coffee or drinks or snacks in. And we'll begin our next panel, which is on imperatives for U.S. health reform in the next 4 years. Obviously a matter of vital interest in the presidential campaign, of vital interest to the folks in this room, and of major consequence in terms of the trajectory of the stakes for innovation and healthcare improvement that we've been talking about all day. To address all this, we have a great roster of folks who are going to come at this from slightly different angles. Let me introduce them briefly again. You can find more material on them in your books at your seats. Then we'll again hear about 7 or 8 minutes of opening perspectives on where the U.S. needs to go over the next several years, a little bit of discussion amongst them, and then ample time for Q&A with this group. But I will say, just in teeing it up, one concern I have in terms of where health reform is headed, and folks can think about this or react to it if you want in your remarks or as we discuss afterward, but the financial tumult and the agenda that's going to leave for the next president in terms of financial institutions reform and regulatory change, as well as the energy and climate agenda that's become so important. I worry, as someone who wants healthcare to happen in a meaningful way systemically in the next 4 years, that the new president's agenda, whoever he is going to be so crowded that that's going to place lots of pressures on this agenda in ways that bear some thinking about. But with that as just a thought, let me briefly introduce Sterling Bryan, who is nearest to me. He is just become professor of health economics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver after a previous stint at Birmingham, and he has been, he didn't invent NICE in the UK, but he practically invented it, has studied it a lot, and has a lot to say about the lessons in terms of how one uses comparative effectiveness in a system of care against the objectives we've been talking about today. Next to him in the middle is Arnold Milstein, who's the medical director of the Pacific Business Group on Health and the chief physician at Mercer Health and Benefits. As many of you know, PBGH is the largest employer healthcare purchasing coalition in the United States. And then finally, at the end of the table, but never last in our hearts in the healthcare debate, is Mark Smith, who is the president and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation, an independent philanthropy with assets of $800 million, headquartered in Oakland and dedicated to improving the health of the people of California through a range of excellent programs and innovations. Let me, without further ado, first welcome Sterling Bryan to come up and share his thoughts.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be back at Stanford. Thank you very much for this invitation, and I should say at the outset that it really is wrong to suggest that I had anything to do with establishing NICE. I've got some experience of the Institute, but I don't want that message to go out. Okay. So the topic area of my talk is the challenge posed by high-cost healthcare interventions, and what I'm going to focus on is policy decisions by healthcare organizations to reimburse or cover such interventions. Now, I think there are some key questions we need to answer at the outset, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you agree or disagree with this this comment. But the first question I think we have to address is, are we willing to set limits on available treatments? So is limit setting on the agenda or not? Now, if limit setting is not on the agenda, then much of what I've got to say is going to be of limited interest, I'm afraid. If limit setting is on the agenda, then we're in business. And for me, the next step is to decide the criteria. So what's the basis upon which we're going to make judgments about setting such limits? And I'm going to talk about cost-effectiveness analysis as one route. And what I'm going to recount is basically a story, which is the story of what's been happening in the UK over recent years. Strictly speaking, what's been happening in England over recent years. And if you want to know why it's not the UK, then I can talk to you afterwards. Okay. But the vast majority of the British population, of course, live in England, so it's of most relevance what's happening in England. Okay, but I don't want to be quoted on that. So NICE and what is NICE and what does it do? NICE is a special health authority It's part of the National Health Service, and it's the body that makes coverage decisions, makes reimbursement decisions in relation to new and existing healthcare technologies in England. Its focus is on selected new and existing healthcare products, primarily drugs, but not exclusively drugs. It's currently, it's entirely funded by the Department of Health, but it's at arm's length from government, and I'll come back to that issue towards the end of what I've got to say. The budget for NICE is some 35 million British pounds, and it's got a staff of about 300 people. NICE essentially determines whether technologies, selected technologies, are available as part of routine care in the British National Health Service. So its technology appraisal decisions are mandatory. It doesn't merely issue advice, it makes policy. It's an obligation that if NICE says yes to a product, that that product is available through the NHS, and if NICE says no, then it's mandatory that that technology is not available. But NICE can say yes to technologies, and often does. NICE can say no to technologies, and infrequently does. It's a myth that NICE says no on many occasions. There are actually only a handful of occasions when NICE has actually said no entirely to a technology. What NICE is much more commonly in the business of saying is yes, but with restrictions. So it's in the business of trying to identify subgroups of patients for whom the technology represents real value. And the example that is often quoted is the example of patients with Alzheimer's disease. NICE was very heavily criticized for saying for its judgment in relation to donepezil and other similar products for patients with Alzheimer's disease, but actually NICE said yes. It said yes to patients with Alzheimer's disease of moderate severity, but said no to patients with mild severity. Okay, now the criteria that NICE uses is, in essence, cost-effectiveness analysis. Cost-effectiveness is a key driver of national reimbursement policy in the UK through this institute. And that's generally accepted. No one really doubts that that is the case. There's research evidence, both quantitative and qualitative, that bears that out. But also, the Secretary of State's directive, when NICE was established in 1999, stated explicitly that the institute was to consider both the broad balance of clinical benefits and costs. So no one can be in any doubt that that's what NICE was expected to do, and that's what it is doing. So how does this play out politically? NICE has the support of all three major political parties in the UK, and so there's no realistic prospect that NICE will fold in the near future. So the emphasis is on how can we strengthen the institute. But it's wrong to suggest that there are no critics. NICE has got lots of critics, both in the political world and elsewhere. And so an example is that the House of Commons Health Select Committee, which published its second inquiry into NICE earlier this year, highlighted concerns most notably around timeliness of guidance. So NICE is criticised for creating a situation of NICE blight, is the term that's used. That it delays the introduction of value technology. So timeliness is a key issue, and that was something that was reiterated by Lord Darcy in his review of the NHS this year. The timeliness was the main concern that the Health Minister, Lord Darcy, indicated as well. So there's a challenge to address those weaknesses. So that's the story about what's happening in the UK in terms of this. Let me just give you one or two observations on the US. You probably know the situation better than I do. I was here a couple of years ago and had conversations with a number of people. Strikes me that cost-effectiveness analysis is making some inroads in US healthcare. People cite WellPoint as a high-profile example of being explicit about cost-effectiveness being used to inform pharmacy policy. And clearly there's much activity targeted at bringing cost-effectiveness analysis to the decision-making table. So the work of this very centre has been central to that, and Alan Garber's work, Peter Newman and his Washington panel from a couple of years ago, and the efforts of Steve Pearson and his ISA initiative. But the Wall Street Journal slide, which will now appear, This was a piece in the Wall Street Journal that came when I was here at Stanford a couple of years ago that speaks to me about some of the challenges that come from thinking about going down this road in a US setting. So it sums up that the path is going to be rocky if simply weighing costs against benefits causes an outcry. If you're not allowed to talk about costs in relation to benefits, if that causes an outcry, then there's going to be clearly some challenges ahead. And just as an aside, if economists are held in such low regard, as is suggested in this piece, then I think that also raises some concerns. Now, for me, the heterogeneity and complexity of the healthcare system in the US makes me doubt the wisdom of simply trying to replicate NICE in a US setting. Having said that, I think and I hope that there are some positive lessons and encouragement to be drawn from the UK experiment. And for me, a key lesson is the importance of independence. So NICE is seen as being an independent body, but with effective engagement from key stakeholder groups. So NICE is at arm's length from both government and industry, and has voices from both the public and from patients. There's a patients' involvement unit and a citizens' council. And just as a testimony to the fact that NICE must be doing something right, it gets criticized for being too close to industry on one hand and for being anti-industry on the other. It gets criticized for being dominated by doctors on the one hand and for not listening to clinical opinions on the other. It gets criticized for being a rationing body on one hand and then for being too liberal on the other. So if it's getting criticized from all of those quarters, then I would argue that it must be doing something right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much, Sterling. We'll hear now from Arnie Milstein.
Thank you. I'm here to talk briefly about what employers who are leaders in pursuit of more cost-effective healthcare are thinking, what their vision is for how tomorrow, rather than in 10 years, we might achieve more cost-effective care, and then finally, what they're doing about it. And in making these comments, I'm in no way representing what the vast majority of employers are doing. I'm talking about the employers who are leading employers or at leading edge. These are typically employers who either are in very low margin businesses, so healthcare cost growth really makes a difference, or employers that have very low wage employees, many of whom can no longer afford their 25% of health insurance premiums. And I use as my illustration for this first slide a family on the left that had the dubious distinction of being on the front page of the New York Times 2 years ago. Who remembers them? Not too many people. This is basically, one of those American families that's in the low middle income part of the distribution. They make $68,000. He's an air conditioning technician. He was running out of gas in terms of paying his 25% share of his health insurance. And his solution, which was certainly far away from finding more cost-effective clinical care, was to try to pick a thin health insurance policy. And they were on the front page of the New York Times because that gamble didn't pay off and the family's bankrupt and that house in the background, which was their total savings, is now evaporated. They're renting. So first of all, the subject here is health reform, so I should comment by saying that, in general, the smart employers that are, after a 60-mile-per-gallon healthcare system while improving quality, they are generally quite supportive of almost anything that seems possible with respect to federal health reform that might improve cost effectiveness, including but not limited to comparative effectiveness research. But by and large, they're not holding their breath for federal health reform. Gail, I think, referred to, voracious appetite. I would say voracious appetite on part of healthcare providers, to sustain incomes. And so their feeling is, fighting against provider and industry's health industry supply chain lobbies in Washington is a challenge. And what they can best do is demonstrate in the private sector much more cost-effective ways of delivering care, and then and then hope that that will help to influence the federal policy debate. Lest you think that's crazy, that's exactly what happened with respect to the law passed a couple years ago by Congress that said Medicare will no longer pay hospitals for preventable complications. I had the dubious distinction of being the person to exhort, to incubate that idea in the House Ways and Means Committee and steered it through and saw very clearly how what really sold it in the end was the fact that there was a private sector health plan, Health Partners in Minneapolis, that was making it work. That was the pivot. So given that their primary path in pursuing health care reform is demonstrating much more cost-effective care themselves, what are they thinking? What are they seeking to encourage? And how are they encouraging it? And I will foreshadow this by saying that they are kind of, in general, of the Hal Luft school of persuasion, that initially, until we get good cost-effectiveness or comparative effectiveness research, the first place to focus is on clinicians who burn a lot less health insurance fuel and get higher quality. So what's their vision? Here's what they're thinking. If the Dorsets, that was the name of the family that was on the front page of the New York Times, if you're going to be able to afford coverage for them and a continual inflow, the kind of medical miracles that that Brooke Byers was describing, U.S. clinicians, and they say the focus on U.S. clinicians is because the employers have figured out that the way state laws are written is that physicians have by far and away the most influence on what care flows and doesn't flow, and they also happen to have the trust of the patients. And so nobody's in a better position to leverage spending and quality than physicians, thus the initial focus on clinicians. They have to achieve two jobs, and I really have to, I credit Andy Grove for helping me think this through, and this is natural thinking for corporate CEOs and HR managers, and frankly for progressive unions that are also struggling with health benefits costs. Two things have to happen if we want to help the Dorsets out. First, we'd have to vastly speed up translational efficiency in the U.S. healthcare delivery system, meaning the average length of time between a better, cheaper way of delivering care being discovered and when it's universal between the industry. And George Halvorsen referred to the fact that currently in the U.S. healthcare system, that interval is about two decades, and George feels, and I agree with him, that it would be possible to create an environment around physicians that might enable that to be 24 months rather than 20 years. What would that enable? That would enable, on a one-time basis, the lowering of the spend rate by about 35%. At least that's what Peter Orszag's, a national panel of experts, estimated to me the average rate of waste in the U.S. healthcare system, spending that could go away without reducing health. And by the way, that's exactly on the mark with the opening chapter of the Institute of Medicine's report on use of clinical reengineering to deliver better, cheaper care, 35%. So no one knows what the number really is in terms of waste, but those are at least two reasonably educated guesses. And how would you do that? Well, what you'd do is you would go to the Dartmouth areas that are already spending 30% less money and achieving very good quality than the other 90% of regions. And then you would, in those areas, you would look at the clinical teams that were distinguished on cost and quality even within those low-spending areas. And I think if you actually run the math on that, the Dartmouth math and the math on opportunity to save money with and improve quality in low-spending areas like Seattle, you also get to about 35%. So we'd have to speed up translational efficiency. The second thing we'd have to do is you have to speed up knowledge turns in healthcare, and not just knowledge turns with respect to better clinical outcomes, which is what a number of speakers talked about, but also knowledge turns on how to deliver current levels of quality less expensively. That's something that remains vastly under-attended to and underdeveloped in the American healthcare system. And I don't envy George Halvorsen trying to sell that to his physicians. Obviously, a lot easier to sell big reductions in preventable illness. Harder to sell intensive focus on doing it less expensively. And as Gail mentioned, if you want to save the Dorsets, you'd basically have to discover knowledge turns in efficiency sufficient to offset that 2 percentage point every year annual rate by which healthcare spending is outpacing American GDP growth. And is that nuts? Well, you know, why have I shown you JetBlue? Well, if anyone would have walked into the United Airlines board, about 20 years ago and said, look, new airlines are going to come into being and deliver the pretty much acceptable customer service and safety at half the ticket prices, the United Airlines board would have laughed Herb Kelleher out of the room. They obviously are not laughing now. So the second thing that large employers are doing is that's how they're thinking. So what is their concept for what might make a difference? Well, they're not experts in healthcare, but they hire people like me to go around and fundamentally ask empirical questions like, for healthcare delivery systems that are burning a lot less health insurance fuel and getting good quality scores, the upper quadrant, those in the upper part of the upper, the most favorable part of the upper quadrant, what are they doing differently? And courtesy of a number of employers and foundations like Marks and RWJ, I've had a chance to scout for such systems, check with their payers to make sure that the lower health insurance burn is real and that it's not coming at the expense of quality. And here is what I see. First of all, what I'm seeing is that these kinds of better, more cost-effective production methods are being explicitly applied and primarily concentrated on people with chronic illness for the reasons that George Halverson indicated. They're spending 70% of the dollars, and there are bigger opportunities there. And secondly, if you look at where these are, what's happening here, it's better primary care for chronically ill patients that is accounting for in what I've found to be a 15 to 20% lower rate of spending within geographies, irrespective of whether you're talking about a high-spending geography like Miami or a low-spending geography like Seattle. And here's basically what they're doing. They're basically re-engineering across two frames. First, they're reducing the number of health crises per year because health crises result in expensive hospitalizations and ER use. And secondly, they're re-engineering cost per contact. They're basically saying, do you need a doctor to do this, or do you need an information, or do you need an electronic health record and a medical assistant to do this, and continuously re-engineering across both those frames? And then here are the three things that they're doing, and I've shown you just examples from outside of healthcare that kind of illustrate the concept. They're doing much more salient caring. They're letting the patients know that it really, really matters to them as to whether they stay out of health trouble. It's a psychological intervention, similar to what Peter described. And they're not just presuming or hoping that an interaction with a patient once a month when they come in to see the doctor could, in a million years, help chronically ill patients do everything they have to do to stay out of trouble. They're using community health workers, promotories, nurse practitioners over the phone to help people between visits. And they're using nice people. That's the Nordstrom reference. They also are focusing on lean production, I've shown you my icon to reduce their cost per contact. And lastly, they are very aggressive about focusing their specialist referrals on specialists who are practicing very conservative, high-quality medicine. And this is exactly what Billy Bean's been saying about how you pick baseball players if you want the best ratio of baseball wins to payroll. What are they doing with this information? I just dissect this into leading employers, maybe a couple hundred Fortune 500 companies, and then leading edge employers, which are maybe a handful, 1% of large companies and progressive unions that are interested in mapping and pushing this innovation in 60 mile per gallon healthcare faster. But the leading edge employers are, as Hal suggested, beginning to tier physician networks and/or work out gain sharing, savings shared arrangements with physicians, in order to fundamentally create a market that encourages physician adoption of benchmark care delivery methods, both quality and low spending. And then last, there's this small group of very leading edge employers and unions that are actually trying to figure out what makes for what would be a conceivable new knowledge turn in healthcare, and are actually paying, in this case, primary care doctors to test some of these innovative methods to see whether or not what appears to be the three illustrations that I gave, whether when those are actually translated in other geographies, do they generate the same gain? This is going across these leading edge employers cut across all industry types, and I've credited a number of the industries from which these leading edge employers originate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Arnie. We'll hear now from Mark Smith.
Thanks. Good afternoon to everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to Alan and Stanford for inviting me. I want to start with an observation and then a disclaimer. The observation is that I've heard almost no discussion of patients today. It is as if this system that we're talking about is acting on inanimate objects who are either provided or not provided care, who are treated in one system or another. It's like we're working on widgets or hamsters. And it's an interesting observation, not only because I think it has to do with how we drive innovation, but with the mindset of the incumbents in this industry. And we are, all of us, incumbents. That's how we got invited. I would point out that you've heard many times today the word reimbursement. Look up reimbursement in the dictionary. It means being paid back for expenses that you've already paid. There is a sense of entitlement to the word reimbursement. You do not reimburse your barber, you pay him. You do not reimburse your lawyer, you pay her. And yet all of us in the doctor and hospital business, it is so deeply ingrained in our outlook on this system that we talk about our payment as reimbursement. So I'd argue that this professional domination, this professional mindset, is really quite extraordinary and quite constipating in healthcare, and why I want to talk about innovation. So the question for this conference is, can innovation save healthcare reform? And that, of course, raises the question, what is healthcare reform? Healthcare reform is basically whatever you want it to be. If you're a hospital, healthcare reform means getting paid more and faster. If you're a doctor, healthcare reform means getting paid more and without any restrictions on what you do. But in the public domain, healthcare reform means, and for the foreseeable future is likely to mean, extending insurance coverage to people who don't have coverage to buy them basically into the current system at the current system's price to see the current providers at their current price points. That's what politicians mean by healthcare reform. And often the words comprehensive and fundamental are attached, which means we're going to do not only what you want to do, but we're going to do what I want to do, too. That's what fundamental means. The reason that this is the content of healthcare reform in the public space is because this is one of the few things that politicians can promise without immediately getting into trouble with one of the constituencies represented in this room. That is to say, we'd like to preserve the power relationships and the income streams as much as possible without these share shifts that Brooke talked about. Oh, and we're going to promise people that we're going to give them something at the same time. I would argue that much of our current insurance system, and some of you have heard me say before, what we call insurance is actually not insurance. It's insurance, it's prepayment, it's discounts, and it's asset transfer. That package, that traditional way of assuring people access, has now become so expensive that our system is unraveling, and our foundation is desperately concerned with innovating in the delivery system such that the benefits of American medicine can be brought to people who do not have such benefits now. It's increasingly dysfunctional, actually, to talk about people in binary fashion as insured or uninsured, because there are people with insurance who are going bankrupt. There are people who are insured by public payers. Medi-Cal is the most notorious, for which insurance is more or less a hunting license to find a provider that will accept that form of repayment. And on the other hand, there are people who are uninsured who are now able to access certain services for less out of pocket than people who are insured. It's not clear to me why we pay Aetna $20 so they can pay Medco $15, so they can pay CVS $10, so CVS can collect a $5 copay from us for something we could have just bought at Walmart for $4 in the first place. That's innovation, actually. And yet our debate in the public space is how can we get everybody into these traditional insurance products that cram together these different lines of business at an increasingly unaffordable rate? So let's talk about affordability. If you didn't hear anything else that was said by the previous speakers, particularly Peter and Gail and others, it is that everybody who's paying says our system is unsustainable because they're paying too much. Everybody who's getting paid says our system is unsustainable because they're not getting paid enough. I submit to you there is no mathematical answer to that problem. There is no payment rate. There's no slider along the linear scale of payment, which is generally how payers try to adjust outflows, that will satisfy both constituencies. So the answer to that has to be reorganization, has to be new business models, has to be, in fact, innovation. There are industries, and Arnie has made reference to some, that actually cost less to do things than they did 20 years ago. And for those of you who like to blame technology for our healthcare costs, telecom has a fair amount of technology in it. Retail has a fair amount of technology in it. The problem is not the technology. The problem is the way in which we diffuse price and adopt that technology or not. And I would argue that the answer to the affordability of healthcare for people in this country has to be, to some extent, the reorganization of the delivery system for which all of these instruments are paying. So when you hear people talk about co-pays and deductibles and taxes and employer contributions and fair share, they are desperately trying to find a way to finance whatever is going on in this black box of healthcare. And I would ask you to be really revolutionary and think inside the box. So some of the things that you heard from Arnie and others about trying to figure out what it is we do inside that box of healthcare have to do with what I would argue are the three places in which we need to direct the stakes in the ground for innovation in the next 4 years. I'm not so unrealistic as to think that we're going to get out of this situation in 4 years, but I'd argue first that we've got to think about innovation in the biomedical sphere that we've heard from Brooke and others. And I would not discount the possibility that there really are breakthroughs that can dramatically change the way in which medicine is delivered and the cost thereof. If you think, actually, ironically, about our obesity epidemic, it is an ironic and unfortunate byproduct of the success of American capitalism, that calories are now so cheap that we can give them away. For most of humankind, we've spent an awful long struggle trying to figure out how to produce enough calories to survive. And yet the genius of American capitalism, I'm not suggesting there aren't downsides, I've read Omnivore's Dilemma too, but the genius of American capitalism is that the crisis of food that one might have predicted in 1920 has actually been innovated out of existence. So I would not discount the capacity for biomedical innovation to dramatically change our patterns of care and the costs that result from them, which is why I think it's appropriate to always worry about stifling those innovations. But it's also appropriate to talk about narrowing them towards the places that can have dramatic and major impact and having them accompanied by information so they don't get adopted willy-nilly beyond their areas of application. Second, I think we need to think about innovation in the delivery system with a small d. Retail clinics, on-site clinics, diabetes-oriented outpatient care, telephone medicine. In most ways, we now do for ourselves many things that would have been thought impossible 20 years ago. Most of you who came here now bank for yourselves, make your own travel arrangements, do all sorts of things that the professionals in those fields 20 years ago would have told you was impossible and dangerous. Every travel agent would have said, God forbid, if you make your own plane reservations, you'll wind up on a different continent. So my sense is, if I were king, I would have a Manhattan Project to move diagnosis and treatment down the skill level, to let nurses do what doctors are doing, to let techs do what nurses are doing, to let patients do what techs are doing. In fact, to achieve cost savings the way every other industry achieves cost savings, developing tools that allow less skilled people to do the work of formerly more skilled people. So I think one of the strategic areas is to move as much as we can out of the professional domain and stop worrying about how we can pay doctors the wages doctors need to do what is no longer doctors' work. And lastly, I think we need innovation delivery system with a capital D, by which I mean the people whom we are paying, the organizations, the providers, the entities that are providing care. For much of the payment reform that Gail and others have reasonably talked about, the fact of the matter is, if there were a payment stream out there today to provide that coordinated, comprehensive, longitudinal, integrated care, there's nobody to pick up that money off a stump. And so the promotion of integration between hospitals and doctors and the promotion of new entrants to this field has to be part of our delivery innovation. Lastly, I'd ask those of you who are venture capitalists to think with us about how we can apply innovations to the least well-served as well as the most well-served in part because, as Clayton Christensen said, you often want to compete with non-consumption. And so rather than going up against all the incumbents in the sweet spot of their income streams, let's pick off some people who are not being well served now and figure out how to do so innovatively and efficiently and see how those innovations might penetrate the rest of the delivery system. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Mark. As usual, we've got more stuff on the table than we can possibly do full justice to, but we'll try and do as much as we can in the time that we have. Sterling, let me start with you. When you, based on your observation and study of NICE, one of the things that when you talk about limit setting as, you know, an essential factor if we're going to make any progress in this, and I'm going to stipulate on behalf of everyone in the room that at least people in this room are comfortable with the idea that we're going to have to set some limits on beneficial care somewhere if we're going to change the cost curves. Talk about the process and the way NICE works, because I think as I understand it, although obviously there's been media backlash on some issues, is it right or just to be effective, does this need to be a more elite process that somehow happens in a way that's a little untransparent for it to actually stick politically? Or by contrast, to do this, do we need more fully transparent, publicly debated things like Oregon tried some years ago about where you draw the line or how you... What would your counsel be to folks thinking about this in the years ahead as to which is likelier to be effective?
Okay. It's an interesting question in the context of developments at NICE, that to date, NICE has made these decisions behind closed doors. So it hasn't been a transparent and public process. And I think it recognizes that that was a mistake. And actually, this month marks the start of public attendance at the meetings where the decisions are being taken. So the coverage decisions are being taken at the appraisal committee meetings, and those meetings now are open to the general public. So NICE has recognized that actually if you want to get true engagement in this process from key stakeholders, and key stakeholders are the public, the patients, as well as government, industry, and other groups, then you need to be open. And I think that's right.
And are we ready for these debates? Is the broad public ready for these debates based on your experience?
Well, I can't talk for the U.S. public. I mean, I think the U.K. public is now quite familiar with these debates. I mean, this has been happening. NICE has been in existence since 1999, and there's been lots of media-generated negative publicity that has caused enormous amounts of debate, and you know we're moving towards a situation where you know that's now recognised that limit setting is something we have to do. Now whether that's the U.S. public is ready for that, I'm not sure.
Arnie, let me bring you in. You talked in a very constructive ways about the ways that employers can try and pilot innovations that model what broader system may be able to take on. There are some who say, and I noticed there are some folks from the Committee for Economic Development in the room here, a business-led think tank that has, in its most recent healthcare analysis, said we need to move beyond the employer-based system if we're going to tackle the problems, ultimately, that the system needs to address. How do you think about the employer role in the period ahead? What are sort of the essential pros and cons, you think, in terms of preserving employer centrality, which is kind of unique in our system, versus the idea by some that we need to really evolve beyond that?
I think it's politically very difficult to take away employer autonomy. Many employers believe that health benefits are a critical element in productivity of their employees and motivating them. And I think it's very politically difficult to take that away. For better or for worse, many employers are, facing, particularly in the low-margin businesses or with low-income employees, are beginning to throw in the towel either directly or by watching passively as 75% of their workforce no longer take up the health benefits that are being offered because they can't afford the 25% share. So I think there will be over time, we already have a national de facto policy of gradual employer attrition. But I do think it's healthy, to have, at the margin, some exemplary large employers that are, much less afraid of the provider community than the U.S. Congress is. you know, actively encouraging and testing physician leadership, especially in discovering and adopting better, cheaper ways of delivering care.
Thanks for that. Now, Mark, there was a lot in what you said we could explore. Let me ask you about the, in terms of sort of your checklist of high priority potential innovative areas, the de-skilling of healthcare, the ability to move down into less expensive levels, what ought to be a component of what we do inside the box to change. Obviously, there are interest groups that fight for nurse staffing ratios, and you know you have the whole medical industrial complex inside that box that's, I guess, a resistor to the de-skilling or reskilling. What's the way to start? What are ways to start that conversation that political leaders and leaders can actually make some progress on and survive?
Yeah, I think it has to do with competing with non-consumption. If you use Arnie's analogy about JetBlue or Southwest, it's probably better. They didn't start with business class travel from LAX to JFK.
Right.
So the foundation, for instance, has funded a pilot project doing diabetic retinopathy screening in the Central Valley of California remotely from the School of Optometry in Berkeley. This is not a big cash cow for ophthalmologists, and they don't object. I don't know that I would start with cataract surgery. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I think we've got to look for places where there's a strong moral case that the current system is not providing care. And so all sorts of areas that have to do with state licensure, telemedicine and its application, I think you have a strong moral case. If there aren't neurologists in this town, the neurologists have a hard time saying, well, you shouldn't be able to do this by telemedicine. So I would look for those places where there's non-consumption, where the incumbents are not that worried because it's an unattractive market or population. I think that's often where you can get an opening wedge.
That's very interesting thoughts. Let me, because I know folks felt we didn't have enough time for Q&A in the last session, let me turn now to our audience to begin asking questions. I know we've got mics that can go to people, and if we're short of questions, I've got lists of them to fill in on, but I want to make sure this group gets a chance to really pepper our experts with their thoughts. This gentleman over here. Do we have a mic on the other side of the room, too, if we need it?
Leighton Reed from Alley Ventures. Hard to do questions for each of you, but I'll just ask one particularly about the NICE experience. Very much appreciated that talk. I'm concerned about the perverse effects of focusing the full force of those economists crunching numbers on only the innovation, and I'm quite interested to hear that part of NICE's mandate is to look at existing technology. If we really focus all of our comparative effectiveness work on the new stuff, we're really shifting the relative burden, whereas we have a lot of very expensive sacred cows that represent by far most of where we're spending our money. How does NICE decide which of the old stuff to focus that attention on, and how do you get that balance right? There are also some important political issues there, because there you really do have incumbents instead of the new kids.
No, that's a really important question. And in fact, one of the criticisms that I didn't mention that NICE received from the House of Commons Health Select Committee earlier this year was exactly that on the focus of its work program being too much on new technologies. And in fact, it's had an increase in its budget in order to expand its horizons to more adequately, or at least to begin the process of looking at existing technologies. And so it's worth saying that the agenda that NICE has is set by politicians. So at the moment, it looks at what politicians tell it to look at. It does that independently, but it's not independent in terms of choosing the topics that it looks at the moment. But again, there's movement on that. Now, I think disinvestment and identifying existing technologies, existing practice that we should be moving away from is central to such a body. Yeah.
I saw this gentleman here.
Yeah, Phil Pizzo from Stanford. I have a follow-up comment to Mark's commentary regarding de-skilling. And I think it's notable and maybe even a bit ironic that the Association of Academic Health Center Medical Schools, AAMC, has been advocating that there actually be a 30% increase in the number of medical school classes. And this is based, of course, on the assumption that there need to be more doctors, yet without any prescription for how they're going to be deployed or employed over the future. And this, I think, is just one more example. You know, if allopathic medicine is doing it, this is being followed, of course, by osteopathic medicine and the for-profits, really flooding the system with a group that I think is less clearly necessary than those who might really help to make our healthcare system work more effectively, and in some degree is really a reflection of what happens when you don't have a healthcare system and all of these free entities really begin moving in different directions.
Any reaction or? No? Okay. Well, sir, I see this gentleman here.
Hi, I'm Joe Minerick from the Committee for Economic Development.
This is mic on, or can we?
I think I can hear it. Let me talk a little louder. Okay. I want to push Arnie a little bit further on the question that he got from Matt. Arnie, I think I agree with absolutely everything you said in answer to the question about what the role of employers is today. In the absence of leadership, employers trying to get the industry to work harder, to try to become more efficient, God bless you, you have to do it. But do you really think that those efforts can get you to the end of the rainbow in terms of a healthcare system with which we would be satisfied? I don't see that getting an expansion of coverage. It's very hard to think of employers having enough leverage over the entire healthcare industry, coast to coast, to actually torque the entire system towards more efficiency. So for all the merit in what employers are doing, don't you think that we have to eventually go to a public policy solution to get us to the system that we need?
Yes. I see this lady over here.
Yes, for an answer.
Hi, I'm Missy from Google Health, and this is for Mark and Arnie specifically. So I really appreciate, Mark, you starting off with the observation that we're not talking about the patient, and obviously, you know, at Google we're thinking about users and patients every day, and we have so much to learn. But I want you to comment about some of the trends that we're seeing around concierge medicine or, you know, direct to bedside diagnostic tests where, you know, you're able to get results in a minute. But how is it that we can start thinking about disintermediating the supply chain of the Medco $10 and then the next person that's getting a cut? Because I, too, believe that employer-sponsored health insurance is not the answer anymore. And, you know, Not to push Arnie on this, but I'm just curious because you are seeing models today where the consumer, the patient, is paying $1,500 a month to have the kind of customer service they want from a doctor. And certainly that leaves a safety net out, but I'm just curious as to if you've looked at studies like that and what your take is.
I'll address just the concierge question and say that in some ways, the innovations that I shared with you in much better management of chronically ill patients did have a number of features of concierge medicine. But I think what distinguishes them as a basis of hope about while we're waiting for more cost-effective technologies to come out of the pipeline, you know, closing that, you know, speeding up our replication of today's, you know, benchmark practices. The thing that's a basis for for optimism is the application of such more intensive management of chronic illness. But if you look at what studies have been done of concierge medicine today, it is unfortunately predominantly, you know, focused on the wealthy, worried well, not on the subset of the population that would benefit the most. So I'm a great believer in taking our sickest patients and doing a lot more to help them stay out of trouble, but I'm not impressed that the concierge solution will address the problems of the Dorsets.
Mark, did you have a thought?
Two comments quickly. One, I think the docs who are developing concierge practice, they don't control the reimbursement environment. I think what they're doing, perhaps in somewhat misguided way, but understandably, is building for themselves kind of a little capitated environment so they can operate in the way they'd like to operate. It makes perfect sense. So you can criticize it, but I understand it. Second thing is I want to point out, because someone asked about patient records before, and full disclosure, I serve on Google's Health Advisory Committee. What's so important about Google and Microsoft and others is the patient-generated demand for a patient medical record. Last May, there was a conference in Fort Lauderdale called Towards the Electronic Patient Record, the TEPR conference. It was the 24th annual conference. So this is true story. This is not a new idea among the chattering classes and the kind of the policy mavens. What's interesting is now the tools converge. You can't do something until things exist. But now the tools are there to be able to have this truly driven by patients, and that, I think, is the most exciting development.
Other questions? Or go ahead. Sure.
George talked about that electronic electronic clinical information is not that useful for clinicians. What's really useful is when that information gets translated into active decision support for doctors and nurses and the care team, so they know what has to happen next and what's not happening that should be happening. I think there's a very analogous, at this point, unharvested opportunity on the patient side of managing one's illness. And that's to not simply say, well, here's a personal health record, you know, isn't it really interesting to see, you know, what money you've spent and your services and your illnesses? I think that will pale in its value to the point at which we begin to introduce electronic clinical decision support for patients so that they know day to day what the opportunities are, either to get a different treatment, a different doctor, a different hospital, different self-management program, in ways that will reduce their out-of-pocket spending and improve their probability of living another year.
Gentlemen here.
Lenny Mendoza from McKinsey. A question for Mark. The challenge that you said about innovating for the underserved. There are a lot of innovations that are happening in various places around the country and around the world that have proven to be cost-effective, both within the system as well as outside the system, whether that's retail clinics or $4 prescriptions. Right. It's a different question about the innovation beginning than how do we scale it. Right. Do you have any thoughts on what we can do to more rapidly scale what works?
Well, this, is where we all would agree policy changes are necessary. And I think part of it starts with saying, at least for us, starts with saying the answer is not going to be that we will find some poor defenseless payer who will agree to ante up to buy everybody into the system. And ironically, many of the people who are advocates, who are honest and passionate advocates for the underserved, are so focused on insuring the uninsured. That's the only thing you can hear them say. So when you talk about this other stuff, it's like they don't want to hear that. It's all about insuring the uninsured. I think there is one wild card here that I was thinking about when Brooke was saying that. It's very common to hear people talk about indicting our country for not being socially responsible. We're the only Western country, blah, 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 blah. But the one time when there was a technology that was life and death, it was clearly immediate life and death, and if you had money, you got it, and if you didn't have money, you didn't, we federalized it. When dialysis happened, renal transplantation happened, we were unable to face the consequences of life and death on the basis of money. And so one of the wild card kickers I think we ought to have in our minds from a policy standpoint is what happens when this combination of diagnostic and therapeutic personalization that costs $80,000 happens and people are confronted with you live and you die because you don't have insurance. Then I think this question of the uninsured or not having a system takes on a different urgency, and I wouldn't bet on the outcome because we're fond of beating ourselves up for saying we're not as organized as they are in England, but the one time people had to actually step up to that question, they had a different response.
Can we spend a nanosecond on the consumer? Because I haven't heard a lot about that, except, Mark, you touched on it with, you know, the Walmart $4 generic as opposed to this whole system, but my favorite recent factoid in healthcare I've learned is Singapore. Singapore spends 5% of GDP on healthcare, or thereabouts, versus the 16 we have, the 10 to 11 other advanced nations. And look, obviously lots of differences culturally. It's a smaller place. There's a benevolent dictator, or has been for several decades. But it's still an astounding fact. And apparently one of the differences is that something like half the money in the system comes out of pocket. Brief words, we don't have time for our whole consumer healthcare debate, but is there something in that has to play a role in how we re-engineer what we're doing?
I think a lot of the statistics we use and the options, we don't take into account the huge amounts of money that people, including low-income uninsured people, pay on either what we would recognize as health care or copper bracelets, herbal remedies, natural products that are for them a substitute for things that fall on the formal insurance system. So I think there's actually a lot more money being spent out of pocket in people's lives than we often acknowledge.
Any other brief thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, Ken Arrow, in the paper that was cited earlier, you know, specified some of the challenges in expecting consumers, average consumers of average intelligence, to rationalize healthcare decision making. I think there are probably opportunities for directional movement that would be constructive, but you'd have to make it a lot easier for people to know clearly what the better choice was, both with respect to how much they would have to spend and their impact on longevity and quality of life. Something analogous to a Jiminy Cricket, on your shoulder, cueing you when there was an opportunity to make a change in treatment or provider that would do you a lot of good.
I think we've got time probably for one last question. I see a lady right here. We can get a microphone over to her.
Ann Copshill, product development executive. What role do you think outsourcing will play in lowering healthcare costs? Other industries have shipped things, overseas. And I used to think, you got to have the patient. That doesn't work. But I think I've read recently that an insurance company was pilot testing, incenting patients if they would go have their surgery somewhere else. Is that much of a solution?
Mark and I wrote a paper on this, wrote two papers on this. And I think, in the near term, it's not going to be, represent much of an opportunity for savings, let alone quality gain. When doctors and actuaries take a look at current American health insurance spending and said, if you were to take every non-urgent expensive surgery for which it might make sense to incentivize the enrollee, including paying for their spouse to get on an airplane, stay in a nice hotel, to actually want to go to a place they've perhaps never heard of before and get care from someone that they've never whose name they can't pronounce, it may be maximum a one-time 1 to 2 percentage point opportunity to reduce American healthcare spending. Now, as telemedicine advances, and if we were to relax our licensing laws, so we would allow physicians from other countries to begin via televideo to deliver chronic illness care, that would be a different story. But for the time being, with current medical licensing laws substantially restricting the ability of offshore providers to do anything more than entice people to fly overseas for a few expensive things, it's not much of a solution.
I think the big opportunity is back office functions. And some of this is clear, people already know, but I'm familiar with at least one company that's now doing a fair amount of medical record review, quality stuff, anything that doesn't require a state license and knowledge of the local culture can now be exported to an English-speaking country, and I think you'll see more and more of that.
So we've got about 30 seconds left, so let's just boil it down in a last thought, since this is about the next 4 years. Let me ask each of you, just about 10 seconds each, if President Palin comes to you and says, I just wanted to see what that sounded like, and says, what's the one thing I should focus on in the next 4 years? How would you put it? Mark Smith.
I would align federal research, biomedical, and health services research priorities to try to attack those areas of greatest opportunity to reduce uncertainty and decrease costs.
Arnie.
Medicare should begin incentivizing primary care doctors to, via gain-sharing opportunities, to reduce total Medicare spending and improve quality, both.
And Sterling, since she's seeking foreign advice as well.
I think it's about generating high-quality evidence where we just don't have it at the moment and being aware of the fact that there is so much service being provided where we don't have a science base. So that would be my advice. Yeah.
Please join me in thanking our wonderful panel for this terrific conversation. There will now be about 14-minute break, and we will resume promptly with our final plenary panel at 4:45. I'm part of the fascination. All right. Welcome back. Hopefully people have had the caffeine boost they need. It's a long day of healthcare debate, but we're not done yet. We have a very exciting hour before we solve the rest of the world's problems. And we're obviously shifting gears here a little bit. This panel is Sustaining Innovation in the Developing World. Till now we've been talking largely about the United States, but obviously the need to innovate in terms of better healthcare at lower cost is arguably an even more pressing concern for that huge portion of humanity that lives in the developing world. Obviously, the challenges in the industrialized nations by comparison seem like good problems to have. How do we manage the affordability of an aging population with all these remarkable new healthcare innovations coming online across the developing world? So many of the basics that we take for granted are simply missing. And as our panel will no doubt explain in detail, the barriers to making progress against this are multiple and complex and hard, including, among other things, just an entirely different level of need for public-private cooperation, a challenge in any context, but particularly challenging in the developing context, as we'll hear. How can the innovation process work in this environment and deliver what we all know it can? Can capitalism and healthcare work in this setting, given so many constraints? In what ways must capitalism potentially bend if we're to achieve the goals that many of us share for the developing world? How should we weigh questions of justice in this mix? Because our evolving approach obviously is going to implicate lots of choices and trade-offs that have a serious effect on some of the most unlucky people on the planet. All of this we're going to explore from several angles of vision with, again, another terrific panel. You know the drill. Let me introduce them briefly. Each will offer about 7 or 8 minutes of opening angles of vision into this set of questions. Then we'll have discussion and obviously leave time for Q&A. Our first speaker will be, but I'll introduce them all just quickly. You've got the materials for more detail, is John C. Martin, to my immediate left, and on your left as you're looking. Dr. Martin joined Gilead Sciences in 1990. He's currently chairman of the Gilead Sciences Board of Directors and CEO. He served as president and chief executive officer for about 10 years before then. Prior to Gilead, Dr. Martin held leadership positions in the antiviral chemistry division at Bristol-Myers Squibb and also served with Syntex Corporation for a number of years before that. He's also on numerous advisory boards and councils dealing with all these questions. So welcome to you, John Martin. Next to John is Melinda Mori. Melinda is currently working as a consultant in global health. She's a senior partner with the Center for Global Development on a project to characterize the markets for drugs and vaccines in middle-income countries. She recently led the supplier consultation project for the Gavi-managed Advanced Market Commitment and, until early 2007, was the director of the Malaria Vaccine Initiative, with which I'm sure you're all familiar. So great welcome to you, Melinda. And then last but of course not least is Paul Wise, who is the Richard Behrman Professor in Child Health at Stanford and a core faculty member at the centers that we are toasting today here at Stanford. He's a health policy and outcomes researcher whose work is focused on children's health policy, the interaction of genetics and the environment in shaping child and maternal health, and the impact of medical technology on disparities in health outcomes. Welcome to you all, and let us begin our session with John Martin.
Okay, thank you. And congratulations, Alan, to you and your colleagues on the 10th anniversary and also for putting together such a successful program. So I'll be using our experience with HIV to talk a little bit about some global health issues. First, by way of background, Gilead is a company that's located halfway between Stanford and San Francisco and Foster City. And in our 21 years of existence, we've come up with 11 drugs, which is a track record of really good productivity, but we're also very proud of our innovation in other areas. And I think as a company, we're probably a little bit different from some of the older pharmaceutical companies in that we have those types of innovations. First, I'd like to talk about two types of medical need. One type of medical need is what we tend to think about in our industry, and you think about when you think about our industry, is the discovery and development of drugs that treat diseases better or treat diseases that haven't been addressed before. The other type of unmet medical need is access to these wonderful new products that our industry is responsible for. And that's a place where we've been criticized in the past and maybe to some extent today because of not enough focus on that. David Gallagher from CHI is sitting at this table, I think, describes this the best. He calls the first type of unmet need, the new drug one, the scientific contract we have with the public. That is that we innovate, discover drugs. The public recognizes IP and allows us a limited period of exclusivity, and the profits of which go back into the discovery of additional new agents. The second contract he referred to as the social contract, and that's the contract that the public expects of us, although it's not often articulated, but it's there at least as an emotional feeling that people want to obviously have access to the products that are the result of our innovations. So we've been at the forefront of global health primarily because of our work on HIV/AIDS. I don't know how many of you know that much about the evolution of drugs for AIDS, but it's really remarkable. AIDS patients need to take three separate drugs to fully control the virus and prevent resistance development. And yet, there were not three drugs available until 12 years ago. And so patients were taking monotherapy or eventually combination therapy of only two drugs, failing rapidly and running out of treatment options. And that's why AIDS was a rapidly fatal disease. In 1996, that changed. There were enough products approved by the FDA so that the disease could be treated with combination therapy, but it was complicated. Patients had to take a lot of pills multiple times per day, and the pills had side effects. If the patient takes the pills, they feel better, but the drugs may be making them feel sick. So it makes it hard for an individual to take all their pills day in and day out for years. As a result, patients were still failing therapy. It's been demonstrated if a patient doesn't take 95% of their medications during the course of a year, during that year they have a 50% chance of developing resistance and running out of treatment options. So our work has been to come up with drugs that are better tolerated, simpler to take. And we have two of the three drugs. And one of the things, this was an area of particular innovation when you think about for our industry. We partnered with another pharmaceutical company, Bristol-Myers, that had a third drug that matched ours, put all three in a single pill so it can be taken once a day. A patient can't miss part of their medication that they either take all or none. Which, as you know, before 12 years ago, single pills are what lead to resistance or single drugs. So this has been an opportunity to provide better care, more people into this. And so we filled the first contract, a scientific contract, that has really converted AIDS into a reasonably well-managed disease. The second part of the contract, access around the world, we even have issues in the United States, and where that can be addressed is by providing free drug through access programs and reducing the barriers to that. So if a patient doesn't have insurance or ability to pay, the doctor can very quickly give them a card that allows them to go to a pharmacy immediately after that appointment to get their pills. In the rest of the world, we embarked on a program of tiered pricing. And this is an innovative program that for one reason it's innovative in the full price markets, US, Europe, Australia, Japan, and Canada, we have consistent pricing that is priced within a fairly tight band. It's really hard to explain to the American public why drugs would be cheaper in Canada, for instance. So that's the top price tier is that. Then middle income countries, we divided into upper middle income and lower middle income. And they pay different prices. An example of an upper middle income would be Brazil. An example of a lower middle income would be Thailand. Not just the economic difference isn't as great there as the prevalence difference, where the burden of HIV is much greater in Thailand than Brazil. And then we have no-profit markets, which are about 100 countries around the world where the product is provided at no profit. It's kind of unique. You think, what other industry provides their product for sale at no profit in those markets, but the drug category is unique, and that's really the right thing to do in this case. But then we found that the uptake of our products, even though just by way of example, 70% of U.S. patients treated for HIV take a Gilead product. In the rest of the world, where the burden of disease is much higher, millions and millions of people are infected, tens of millions, and up to maybe 2 million now are being treated. We have a much smaller market share. And so somehow the economics weren't working. So we embarked under a grand experiment. It's really Greg Alton's group, and he's here in the audience, to see if we can provide greater incentives and competition. So what we did was license the manufacturing technology to some Indian generics, teach them how to manufacture a drug, and let them compete without restriction in these markets so that there'd be economic competition. And so far that, we thought in theory it should work, but we weren't sure that economics would actually prevail under these types of circumstances. But so far it seems to be working quite well. We've gone from less than 50,000 patients on our lead product about a year and a half ago to several hundred thousand now. So this model seems to be working, where competition among various companies that can make a profit, the generic drug industry can make a profit in these markets, is competing, that they're competing to get patients on drug, and so ultimately the patients will benefit. So this is a pretty innovative approach. There are still a lot of other barriers. We all know about the healthcare systems, but you may not know that regulatory approvals take much longer in many of these countries than it does in the United States and Europe, for instance. Regulatory approval in the United States is 6 to 10 months, but it can be years in countries in sub-Saharan Africa. There's another thing that's kind of really remarkable when we're thinking about having the cheapest possible drugs out there. Many countries around the world still mark up the price of drugs by 50%, putting an import duty on them, thus further restricting the ability of a set amount of dollars to provide drug broadly across the board. However, what's happened over the last few years has been extremely positive. The number of people getting access to medication has been growing pretty dramatically. And it's through the cooperation of industry groups, government organizations, NGOs, and, of course, academic institutions. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, John. We'll hear now from Melinda Mori.
Good afternoon, and congratulations to Alan for the 10-year anniversary and to Kathy for pulling off this quite interesting conference. I've really enjoyed the time here today. You know, AIDS kills over 3 million people, TB kills over 2 million people, and malaria almost 1 million people a year. And we kind of hear those numbers, and it's like, how do you make any sense of it? So in my own limited way of trying to make sense of it, I think about analogous systems. So my son is in elementary school. There are about 500 kids in his school. And if kids in his school died at the same rate that kids in sub-Saharan Africa die, over the course of the time before they graduate from fifth grade, 71 of those kids would die. And that would be a funeral about every 4 weeks or so. It's something that to me is just unimaginable. You know, that would never happen here. And I guess I think that anything that's unimaginable here shouldn't be acceptable anywhere else. And that's the reason that I'm going to talk to you today about some of the things that are being done. The public sector and nonprofit sector, up until maybe 10 years ago, stood very firmly on that moral high ground of need. And we talked over and over about how many people need access to new drugs, vaccines, and interventions. And sort of stood on the moral high ground and shook fingers at industry in particular and said, you ought to do something. You should do something. And I think industry, you know, over time has been very patient and sort of explained back that they're actually an industry that's run on demand, not need. And that we look for demand for products, it's really not there. And so they were kind of like, well, I don't know what you expect us to do with this. So in the last 10 years, I think there's really been a revolution, and the revolution is one of culture. And it's one where the private sector and the public sector are starting to come together and recognize the relative strengths and weaknesses of each sector and what can be done instead of sort of pointing at what should be done. So one of the ways to try and bridge this innovation gap, where you don't have market forces that are driving this translation from kind of the early discovery into products, was to find two different ways of doing it. And I think this was a real coming together of everyone agreed that there's just not enough money in the system to make this all work. So existing products, cheap products, not being purchased and used in developing countries. So there were a couple of things that were done, put purchase funds into place. So the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria has now committed $11 billion in 136 countries to buy drugs and other interventions for malaria, TB, and HIV, and also to support the health systems that will deliver these. The other thing that was, there's another one, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, which now has raised $3 billion to go toward the purchase of vaccines. And surprise, surprise, when there's money, the uptake of these vaccines changes dramatically. So now most countries have introduced hepatitis B vaccine in a short period of time. But the other part that I'm here to talk about today is on the product development side of things. And this big gap where you don't have market forces driving some kind of bridge between these. And what was developed at the time was this product development partnership, and sometimes called public-private partnerships, but trying to say this is really about making new products, drugs, vaccines, diagnostics for the developing world. So, you know, the history of this is in 1997, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the first of these called the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, which is still going strong. And the idea was to fund this organization to try and step into the gap between industry and good academic ideas and drive products forward into clinical testing. On that followed the program that I ran, the Malaria Vaccine Initiative, others for malaria drugs, TB drugs and vaccines, another one for diagnostics, and several other, but there are about 10 that are sort of well-funded and what I would call robust programs. The characteristics of these is that they're either nonprofits or foundations. They try as much as possible, although some would argue, to run by an industrial style of management. They create infrastructure to help everyone move their products forward. So there's a lot of infrastructure building that's happened in Africa and Asia about the ability to do clinical trials of promising candidates that really 5 years ago didn't exist. And these are regulatory trials where you've got to have certain levels and standards on your data. And a lot of these countries are stepping up and meeting that. So there's a whole new environment now for the infrastructure for actually testing these products in the developing world. One of the other parts, which we've never found a good word for, is we call it creating an enabling environment, and essentially trying to get the public sector aligned in creating an environment that is conducive to moving these products forward, testing them, getting them licensed, financing around them, that really, largely, the private sector said, look, this isn't our role, and I think rightly so, and so these product development partnerships have tried to step in to organize the public sector. It was always one of the funny things of people would, when we first started MBI, they'd say, oh, you're going to try and get the private sector organized, and it's like, no, actually, we're going to try and organize the public sector, which always tends to be a bit harder. Okay, it's a lot harder, actually. So what are the results of this? So I should say that I was just trying to count up how much money has gone in, and just for HIV vaccines, TB drugs and vaccines, malaria drugs and vaccines, in the past few years, there's been $2 billion worth of investment in this. Some of these organizations are much more well-funded than biotech companies and have a lot of capital behind them. So the results of this, first of all, I'd just like to say that it's hard to evaluate the results because there is no evaluation framework. In some ways, this is similar to industry trying to make products, but in other ways, it's very dissimilar. I remember one time bringing in a group of CEOs to give us advice, and it took the first half of the day for them to go, like, well, you just shouldn't work on this. And we're trying to make a malaria vaccine, and they just couldn't find an economically appealing argument why we should be doing what we were doing. In the afternoon, we all kind of came together and moved on with it. But there's not really an evaluation framework, and it's hard because it's different than what industry's doing. There was a report by Mary Moran at the George Institute that took a look at the drug product development partnerships and was able to show a substantial increase in the pipelines of products for these neglected diseases, and also to show that there was indeed value for money in this approach. So the successes, there have been some. These are very hard diseases for the most part that we've all been working on. But in the Malaria Vaccine Initiative, we were able to show for the first time ever proof of concept that a vaccine can protect children in Africa from malaria. And that was a partnership with GlaxoSmithKline that products going into phase 3 clinical testing. That wouldn't have happened, and you can talk to Jean-Stéphane, the CEO, wouldn't have happened without the input from philanthropy in the public sector on that. There have also been a lot of disappointments, and a good part of what these groups have been doing is actually testing products to the point of failure. which is something that usually doesn't happen in the academic environment because when your product fails, you don't have any more money for it. But these groups, actually, the portfolio approach incentivizes them to kill products. But it leaves us with a bit of an issue because a lot of those pipelines that looked so rich a few years ago are starting to dry up a bit. So what hasn't happened as a result? A lot of things have happened. The pipelines are full. A lot of money is going in. Infrastructure built. Easier to test these products. But what hasn't happened is one of the groups that we have just utterly, almost utterly failed to attract are the pre-profit large biotech companies, which some people term capable innovators. They're too big that they don't really need the money. It's more of a distraction to them. But they're not so big that they're worried about their corporate image and trying to give things away. They're just trying to break even. And so we failed to engage them and to find the right incentives and right mechanisms for making that happen. I think that we also may be seeing the limits of what pharma will do around corporate social responsibility. I personally am not a fan of that model for supplying needed drugs to poor people, but I'm sure we can talk about that later. I'll just skip down because a little light is blowing, but I hope that we can pick up on the fact that, you know, right now many good things are happening. A lot of it is in this corporate social responsibility philanthropy model, which has really moved us substantially forward in having pipelines for these products and setting up a better environment for all of it to move forward. But I think that we are seeing the limits of that. And I think anytime we create a bridge, we should make sure that when we get to the other side of that bridge, that we're actually at a place that we want to be and that we've used our money effectively to get the most value from that. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Melinda. We'll hear now from Paul Wise.
Thanks very much. I, too, want to congratulate Alan, Kathy, everybody at CHPP Corp. As somebody who actually works at CHPP Corp, I can tell you it's really a remarkable place. You've created a special kind of academic unit that combines a kind of intense intellectual creativity with a generosity of spirit that I have rarely seen in academic settings. And I'm very grateful for allowing me to, the new guy from Boston, to work with you guys. I was asked to present the perspective of a physician who works in the developing world, policy, but also on the ground, working with patients and health programs in different parts of the developing world. And one thing I've learned is when Alan and Kathy ask me to do something, I do it. Particularly Kathy, I do it. And the perspective I want to convey to you today is a perspective of desperation. I don't need to tell the people in this audience, a very informed audience, particularly coming up here after John and Melinda, to tell you about the profound need that exists in the provision of health services in the developing world. However, I do need to insert some sense of urgency to the discussion that we're having today. Because if you spend any time on the ground providing care in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, Caribbean, particularly now Haiti, India, you come away with a sense of urgency that may not be conveyed in these kinds of conversations we're having today. Now, again, I don't need to document what the need is to an audience like this. What I'd rather do, to talk about at a conference on innovation, is what, in fact, is the relationship between innovation and desperation. In other words, what is the relationship between technical progress, new discovery, and the kind of real needs that exist on the ground. And the reality is, in a highly stratified system of delivery, in a terribly inadequate system of delivery, new discovery, new efficacy coming out of places like this will worsen inequalities in health outcomes. In a setting of profound stratified system of healthcare, new efficacy will exacerbate, not generally reduce, inequalities in health outcomes. As efficacy grows, as innovation grows, so too does the burden on society to provide that efficacy equitably to all people in need. The lexicon of innovation, therefore, speaks directly to questions of social justice. They are not detached entities, that in fact, every new innovation, all new efficacy, speaks directly to questions of equality and social justice. More children die in the developing world from conditions for which we have very good preventive interventions and cures. Let me repeat that. The majority of children who die now in the developing world die from conditions that we already have highly efficacious interventions. There are many explanations for this, many good explanations for this, but there are no excuses. There's no real reason for why we should allow this to continue. There are kids dying from H flu pneumonia in the developing world. We basically have eradicated invasive H flu disease in much of the developed world through immunization that's been available for more than 15 years. Now, my plea, in essence, is that we extend how we think about innovation, not merely talking about the creation of new efficacy, and of course, that's critical, and I'm very glad that we're talking about that, but my hope is that we can extend notions of innovation into the delivery systems themselves. There is money sitting in the bank for the various global funds to address HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and it just sits in the bank because it cannot be utilized effectively on the ground because our capabilities, our systems of delivery, are just so weak in the areas that need it most. My hope is that we can think more creatively about building linkages between the business community, private industry, but particularly in academia, to begin to focus the enormous resources in a place like Stanford on developing far more innovative, more creative ways to get the efficacy that we have now, much less what's coming down the pipeline, out to the people who really need it. We talk about it as the last mile. Working with people in the business school, working with people in the Freeman Spogli Institute, political scientists, people who have experience on the ground, trying to develop new ways to ensure that new efficacy ultimately gets to the people that need it most. The death of any child, the death of every child, is always a tragedy. But the death of any child from preventable causes is always unjust. Therefore, there is a remarkable urgency to the conversations taking place at the conference today. Second, that we need to try to expand our vision of innovation and our engagement at universities like this to focus on mechanisms, the new machinery that will be required to get new efficacy to people who need it most. And ultimately, my hope is that by doing this much more creative innovation directed at the implementation of our new expanding efficacy, that we will be able to respond more effectively and more urgently to the recognition that the dual struggles, the struggle for innovation and the struggle for justice, will forever be inextricably linked. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for that really eloquent framing of these issues. Again, we have a full plate, and we won't be able to, speaking of justice, we won't be able to do full justice to this as usual. But let me start, John, let me start back with you and see if we can tease some of this out. You talked about the regulatory approval process in these countries
Can you broaden it a little bit just so people have a sense of when people talk about the barriers to sort of what where we need to go in this terrain? And some of these are sensitive issues, but, you know, it's not a mystery or a secret that the quality of governance in a lot of countries is not what's needed to be able to serve the population. There are issues of corruption, again, sensitive issues, but stuff that businesses and others deal with on the ground every day. What's the right way to think about this set of barriers, and what's the agenda sound like to begin to overcome them?
Well, yeah, okay, well, there's a lot in your question, of course. The regulatory process can take 4 or 5 years, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One of the simplest ones is there's just not the infrastructure in place. That's what Paul was talking about in area after area. And yet we felt very urgent to get this regulatory approval. But once we got the approvals, we still found the uptake of our product was very slow. And, you know, just to be clear, when the therapy is simplified with better drugs, more and more people here in the United States, it's not only that 70% of the people are on our product, it's also that more people are taking it. When three-drug combination first started in 1996, the idea was, let's just treat everyone because if someone has HIV, if you don't treat them, they have progressive destruction of the immune system, so let's treat early. But there quickly became the realization, if you treat early when someone feels healthy, they don't take all their medication, develop resistance, and then run out of options when they really need it. So by having products that are easier to take, then that should be, you know, the type of product that would do well in the situations that Paul was describing. For instance, a lot of, if you have side effects or you need laboratory monitoring, where the healthcare infrastructure is not present, those drugs don't have any value. Also, if you have to take 3 different pills, but you're in an environment where people won't be able to get all 3 pills, they'll be taking 2 or 1 and developing resistance, and that does more harm than good. So one of the things we did along the way, well, we supported was an MRC study that was a very large study in sub-Saharan Africa. Usually think of studies comparing drug regimens, and that's what this did. But the most important comparison, and the reason the study was designed, to look at patients divided in half and half to get the type of laboratory monitoring you'd get in the United States, or just clinical monitoring, because the economics or the availability of laboratory monitoring would not be available. So the goal was to see whether or not one of the more modern regimens could be safely administered without the detailed laboratory monitoring we would all get here in our medical care in the United States. And I think that proved to be a very important study. But still, with all of that, we found the uptake slow until we injected a level of economic competition by enabling the generics. And, you know, the drugs being paid for, there's a variety of funds around the world. There's the U.S. has a very large fund, but it takes more than that. And I believe, Paul, that's what you're talking about, the urgency of how to make these things really be effective.
Thanks, John. Melinda, talk a little more about, you sort of hinted at the limits of CSR as a model and the debate over that. Say a little more about what you think folks ought to think about that question and where it heads.
So who read the Wall Street Journal this morning? Financial collapse, you know, all of these sort of things. I don't want to be at the bottom of the economic food chain when, if it's my only way to access drugs. And so when we leave things up to a philanthropic model or sort of a giveaway part, I don't think that that's sustainable over the long term. And I worries about, you know, price erosion and what that does to major markets. I mean, there are a lot of legitimate concerns around that, which has led to a model which is sort of charging really high prices in high-income countries and then giving it away to the poor. In some ways, so we don't have to deal with that issue of who can afford to pay what and how do we fine-tune that. And I just think it's a model that's gotten us thus far, so I don't want to say that's a bad model, but I think we're going to have to evolve from that. You know, it's there are lots of people dying of AIDS, TB, and malaria, but most people, you know, so 83% of the world's population is in low and middle income countries. Most of those people are dying of chronic diseases. And we don't have specific funds to address those. But, you know, there is economic potential. And so, personally, I'm trying to turn my attention more to economic drivers because I have more faith in those for the long term to solve the problems. And again, it doesn't mean that the things that people are doing are wrong or bad or misguided. I just think it has its limits. And in order to really get to the point, it's that end game, right? It's not just getting drugs for HIV. It's improving health and improving the quality of health for poor people living in poor countries. That's the end game. And if people are dying of chronic diseases, we need to make sure that they've got medicines for chronic diseases and healthcare systems, which are especially challenging for chronic diseases, that can deliver that kind of care. We have to think much bigger than what we're thinking now.
And just briefly then, what would be sort of your dream agenda for the next phase of how we go in that direction?
Well, you know, it's a place where, part of, we've got some good drivers. So the pharmaceutical industry is, you know, still continuing its decade-long decrease in growth in its market. There are a lot of pressures on that current business model. One way is to go to personalized medicine and try and keep eking profits out of the current system. The other, as I think someone mentioned this morning, is, you know, why not go to the place where there's less competition and start to create business models that may look very different than the current business models. And I think part of the problem is, you know, just the revenue differential. So you take five leading emerging economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they constitute 5% of the pharmaceutical market versus the U.S., which is half. Okay, so I understand why people focus on the U.S. pharmaceutical market. But they're 5% now, but it's growing. And that's where the high growth rates are. I don't know when that sweet spot will be where they can actually start replacing revenue, but it's coming. You know, everything indicates that that's coming. So, you know, personally, I would want to be out on the forefront of that instead of sort of arguing over the reimbursement in the U.S. Go to the open territory, go to the open space. And I think it's still largely unexplored.
Paul, let me bring you into this. You spoke very powerfully about what the moral urgency is of addressing this stuff. If you were, we brought up a benevolent dictator before, so if you were a benevolent dictator here, What would your thunderbolts be on this? What would you be saying the U.S. should be doing to sort of lead in this agenda?
Well, I like the idea of being far more creative that's been discussed before. But I think we need to disentangle who we're really talking about. I'm not as concerned about Argentina, Brazil, China, and South Africa. I'm worried about the poorest people in those countries and the people in Haiti, Guatemala, and sub-Saharan Africa. And the approach there may need to be different, at least initially, in those kinds of areas. I think one is right now we have a hugely chaotic policy approach to the provision of health services in those areas, where NGOs have created parallel systems to national health systems in ways that's understandable at some level, but in the end is not only not sustainable, but also, I think, counterproductive. I think that the United States specifically should work far more aggressively to hold national governments accountable for the building of infrastructure and the provision of services to their people. Several of the projects we're working on with the Freeman Spokley Institute is to look at what kinds of national government policies are actually quite effective in providing expanded health service delivery in some of the poorest places on earth. Some of the findings are quite surprising in what we're learning about that. But my hope would be to bring this out of just a philanthropy model, as you're suggesting, and bring it back into where it belongs, into the negotiation of national ministries of health, working with global organizations, and hold them accountable for this. One study a student working with us did very recently found that about 40% of all child deaths in sub-Saharan Africa are occurring in countries in the midst of civil war. So how the heck are you supposed to provide antiretroviral therapy to kids if on an NGO model built in places that everything is just fine? We need new, much more creative ways, working with political scientists, working with security experts, to get these services to some of the places we've just ignored.
How, just sticking with you, Paul, for one second, you raised a, if it's not depressing enough, the challenges you talk about, the collision between the sort of new era of medical innovation that we seem to be on the threshold of, the personalized medicine, et cetera, combined with the aging of the baby boom population and the way that this is all going to conspire to drive, put enormous fiscal pressure on the advanced nations who already have trillions in unfunded liabilities anyway in these programs, makes one think that's going to make us even less magnanimous to the developing world when everybody's scrambling to become a have and not a have-not in the new world of healthcare in the advanced countries. Say something that will tell me my depressing feeling now is wrong.
I would want
you
to
see what
you,
I mean, obviously.
I do. I wouldn't want to leave you real depressed. I see opportunities here as well. And I see a lot of
That's
people,
good.
I see a lot of people working, people from these countries working to engage these issues in fundamental ways. So it's an urgent issue, but it's not a depressing moment, I don't think. You know, the whole day, if nothing else, has conveyed a message of complexity in dealing with the healthcare system in the United States. And I'm, in my 30 seconds, I'm not going to give you a brilliant answer that is going to be better than all the other brilliant answers that we've heard here today. But I do think it's important to keep some sense of the scale of expenditures we're talking about. The Global Fund is an amazing creation. Melinda mentioned $11 billion. That's about 6 weeks of the Iraq War. I mean, it's not pro or con the Iraq War. It's just a statement about the scale of expenditure we're talking about. And my sense is that we have a lot more freedom to think about expenditures in these places if we could ensure that, in fact, that it'll be spent better than the way we've spent so far.
Let me, John, I want to get you in for a last question here, but formulate your questions because we're about to go to you all in the audience and there'll be microphones available, so think of what you want to ask. But, John, I wanted to give you a chance both to react to some of the stuff that Paul had said, and if you want, to Melinda's notion about the limits of CSR and whether we can, from your own experience, really harness the power of capitalism in a way that's going to work against these problems. And what it would take.
Yeah, well, I agree with everything Paul said. It's the complexities and the need to have things operate correctly, I guess, is a real challenge in a lot of this. But it is the question of economics. So turning it over to Indian generic manufacturers that operate in that area, as I said, we do not constrain them on pricing. In some instances, their prices would be higher than what ours are. Some they're lower, and that's our no-profit price. And we're seeing that have an impact in these markets, and that's something that, it's early days. I don't know where it's going to end up, but it's consistent with what Melinda's talking about.
And can a no-profit price as part of your portfolio of business work for your shareholders, your board, the sort of traditional pressures you face in running a U.S.-based firm?
Yeah, it's fine because the companies that have tried to make profits in these environments have really struggled with it, and it's just considered by so many individuals as inappropriate for the brand of pharmaceutical but okay for the generic, and I think that's why we've made this into a generic market. We're a relatively new company, and our products were launched. Our first AIDS drug was the 17th AIDS drug approved on the market. So there are a lot of products out there already. And we didn't put it on into sub-Saharan Africa right away at approval at a no-profit price. For one thing, it takes a while to get regulatory approvals, but for another is you really do, with a new drug, need quite a bit of commercial experience before you can be confident with the safety profile. So you don't want to turn it loose somewhere where it's not going to be monitored that well. But once we were confident, we made it available at no profit, and people from various media outlets would come and would they call and say, how could you make that decision? Was that a tough decision? And frankly, at our company, we never really debated. It was just the obvious path to take in those particular markets. And we've gone through all the steps we've gone through over the last several years to get to where we are now.
Let's go to your questions. Please raise your hand. I see this gentleman here. We can get a microphone over swiftly, I hope.
I've been here all day. And love.
Here's a microphone for you. Tell us who you are again, sir.
I'm Walter Bortz from Stanford. I've been here all day and love it, but I hear technology and drugs. I do not hear prevention, and I hear that there are 2 million under treatment for AIDS and 5 million getting it, but we talk about the treatment. We have diabetes, 20 million people in America, and we're talking about drugs and genes. We have a diabetes prevention trial with lifestyle that prevents 70% of diabetes. I did not hear discussion on those topics today.
Which of you want to take the blame for that?
I'll step right up. You know, having worked on a vaccine initiative for 8 years of my life, I feel like I'm completely devoted to prevention. And I think that there is a lot going on in that model. So if you look at the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, you know, if you project out the cost of antiretroviral care into the future and really the entitlement of that, it starts getting up into $50, $60 billion a year very, very quickly. Okay? It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable by governments. It's not sustainable by donors. And that's one of the arguments that's being used to put so much money still into an HIV vaccine, even though the science is probably about as hard as it gets. And so I think there is a lot, and that is the role where philanthropy is stepping in and saying, market or no market, we've got to be looking at what are the most acute needs that are out there. You know, for malaria, a vaccine is really hard. In the interim, there are drugs, there are bed nets, there are ways that you can prevent malaria, and people are doing everything they can. That's the Global Fund, to try and get those things out there. So, I mean, I think there really is a prevention mindset when it comes to the global health community. When you marry that with the pharmaceutical industry, mostly focused at high-income countries, I think there we have some challenges.
Other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I can add. You,
please.
So, the HIV vaccine, it always seems to be 10 years away.
And one's saying that anymore, though.
Yeah, the problem in the last year, it got further away than it was a year ago, I guess, that we've had some setbacks in the science. There are a lot of other things going on, and I can tell you a little bit about what we're doing in the United States or what the U.S. government is doing. The U.S. government, in the year 2000, made it their goal, and prevention's the key, as you're saying, made it their goal to cut the number of new infections by half. So we're at 40,000 in the year 2000. In 2005, we were still at 40, so the effort failed. And there, and hundreds of millions of dollars went into various educational programs to achieve that. In the meantime, the demographics of the epidemic in the U.S. changed. So instead of 40,000, we're now at 56,000 new infections a year. And so what the key thing is over half of the new infections come from the 25% of people that aren't diagnosed and know that they are infected. So the key is diagnosis, to get people to know their status, modify their behavior, and reduce the transmission rate. And part of the problem in the U.S. is that because HIV is a relatively recent disease without a treatment initially and a lot of stigma, there are special rules around testing for HIV. If you go to a doctor gets an informed, basically you sign consent and they can give you a variety of tests. But HIV required a separate informed written consent and pretest counseling is time consuming. And so the people that are needing the testing weren't getting tested. The CDC provided new guidance about a year and a half ago saying that this should be part of routine medical care. And more that's become the case. For instance, the state of California redid their legislation at the beginning of this year to make HIV testing part of routine medical care. Now, the scale outside, so we're talking about in the United States where for every person on, there's 10 people on treatment for one that's infected each year, whereas the numbers are the reverse in the rest of the world at a much staggering larger number. So the ability, as Melinda said, to do that is just a staggering challenge, I guess.
I saw this gentleman over here. If we can bring a microphone over.
A question for John, or actually maybe...
Who are you again, sir?
Oh, sorry, Peter Farrell, ResMed, La Jolla, or San Diego.
question for John, or two questions actually. The first one, is there anybody else using this same economic model that you're using for Atripla, the three-tiered pricing and also licensing to generics and so forth? Just curious about that. The second question is, and maybe I was napping when you discussed this, but the actual economics of the relationship with the Indian generic manufacturer, as I understood, you said you were competing with them in certain markets, but what was the relationship, the deal that you actually did with them before you allowed them to compete?
Yeah, so I think other companies with various products have aspects of this model, Peter, that get you there, but the challenge, I think we'll see more and more of it. It's so simplified. The concern that we have more, though, is globally is the respective intellectual property. That's a concern broadly of our industry and in the middle-income markets, too. And there are a number of forces in the world that are anti-intellectual property, but then there would go the innovation. So that's very important. Peter, all we really care about in the developing world is more patients on drug. It's a nonprofit market for us, and so it makes a lot of sense. And the terms of the deal are that they have those markets and not other markets, and also that they're not marketing our brand. They have their own generic version. I should also say that one of the concerns that exists in our industry is product movement from no-profit markets to profit markets. And to that end, the FDA partnered with us in a particularly innovative way because it wasn't clear that they had the guidelines. But they approved a different trade dress and a different color pill very quickly once we submitted a package to them for our no-profit markets. Now, I didn't mention that earlier, but that was something that the FDA really did partner with us on, and other companies are now doing that too.
So you could know if it was bleeding into your...
You would.
Interesting. Other questions, comments, concerns? People are speechless at the end of the day. Not going to be forced to mention Sarah Palin again, am I? This gentleman right here?
Well, thank you, all three of you, very much. I'm Grant Miller. I'm here at Stanford. My questions are for the first two of you and not Paul, since Paul can tell me all day long what's wrong with my silly ideas. So I know that a major strategy for enticing innovation to focus more on developing country health issues are pull mechanisms, advanced purchase commitments, other sorts of financial rewards for successful innovation. Paul, I think, also makes a terrific point that for a lot of leading killers and causes of morbidity in low-income countries, there are reasonably effective technologies that exist, and so a major problem then is getting people to use them. There are some very complicated problems on the supply side that are particularly pernicious in developing countries, but I think there are general issues that have come up today in the United States as well. There are also some fairly large puzzles on the demand side about low adoption rates of technologies, conditional on them existing, them being available for free. My hunch is that this might partly be related to product design types of features. People don't like the taste of chlorine in point-of-use drinking water disinfectants. There are undesirable things about using insecticide-treated bed nets. So my question, I suppose, is, do you think that there's any scope for a viable model of pull-type mechanisms that focus on product design features that would lead to technologies that would be adopted at much higher rates, not replacing, but perhaps in addition to pull mechanisms that focus on more fundamental, basic, scientific advance? Thanks.
I'll start. You can jump in. So I think a couple of things. The advanced market commitment, where a bunch of donors put up $1.5 billion to buy pneumococcal vaccines, I think is actually one of those examples, because a big part of that was developing a target product profile that was appropriate for the developing world. So Prevnar, the 7-valent vaccine, doesn't have many of the serotypes that are present in developing countries. And so the bar was raised for this advanced market commitment in order to sort of pull the, at this point, not really development, but production of vaccines sufficient to meet the needs of the developing world. So I think there is some of that's going on now to say, you know, it's not enough to just take the leftover product, you know, when you sort of get done with your 20 years and it's off patent and we'll take it.
but to say, actually, there needs to be innovation for the developing world. The more money there is in the system, the more innovation there is. And there's sort of a long history of this in the vaccine world that I won't go into, but we can talk about later. I think the other point that you make is one of technology diffusion and demand. And we are appallingly ignorant of the consumer characteristics and the market characteristics in most developing countries. And usually there are sort of well-intentioned people like me and others that sort of put together product profiles and other things that, you know, really oftentimes have very little to bear with what the consumer would want. And some of these are not consumer markets, so they differ a little bit. But I think there's a huge scope. I mean, McKinsey Global Institute did a couple of nice studies, one in India, one in China, of looking at the consumer market. Who's spending what? Why? What's driving that? We don't have anything like that for most of the countries that we're working in, and I think it's a great big black hole.
John, did you have any other?
No, nothing.
Well, our time is getting short. Are there other, do we have a last question? We could do a quick question and answer if there's somebody else. I see fingers pointing, but I'm blinded by this light. Is there someone there? I'm sorry, I couldn't see.
Someone's standing right there.
Tell us who you are.
Tom Newman from UC San Francisco. I appreciated the comment about prevention, sort of going back up to the cause of the problems. And I'm wondering about, when talking about health problems in poor countries, whether it's considered even a legitimate question to ask why the countries are poor and why the gap between the poor and the rich countries has gotten wider, and to what extent policies of the rich countries have made that worse. I'll just give as an example, farm policies, you know, farm subsidies in the U.S. and the effects that have on poor countries. And is that a legitimate question for people interested in health of poor countries to even think about and talk about?
Paul,
thank you. Well, clearly, I think it's more than legitimate. It's essential, if not central. And when we talk about prevention, pediatrician, we talk about vaccines, we're also talking about nutrition. Malnutrition is at the heart of most of the infectious disease mortality in the places I worry about, which is clearly related to overall poverty levels, but also food policy. The price of food commodities in most of the developing world has doubled, particularly corn in Central America. Corn prices have doubled. The implications for health are astounding. We're seeing it now ripple through the epidemiology of the area. So I think it's essential, and it's important for people in the health field to see it, because ultimately clinicians are the ultimate inheritor of bad social policy. Ultimately, we see it on the wards, in the clinics, in the morgue of social policies, public policies, international policies that are poorly constructed and or poorly implemented. So we have an opportunity, if not a responsibility, to narrate what the impact of these policies really are in public discourse.
Let me, since we've got just 1 minute left, let me ask each of you very briefly, and John, I'll start with you and move down to Melinda and then Paul. Just in summing up, if you had to say on a scale of 0 to 100, where 100 would be kind of the nirvana of social justice and economic rationality and all these terrains we're talking about, and 0 would be the depths of, hell, where are we today on that scale, and what's one thing that should give people hope about the trajectory of progress in the years ahead? John?
In my mind, it's less than 10. I don't know what they think. They probably think, I think Paul thinks it's probably lower.
That like, sounds good.
But
I was going to say 11. But.
Okay. the one thing does give me hope is I feel like the trajectory has improved over the last few years. That's the thing that I would say.
Melinda?
I'm a little more generous today. I would give it a 20. And I think because part of the discussion has shifted to what someone asked today, which is how do you take these things to scale? We spent so much time and energy on, you know, this works in this district and this country and that district and that, and an NGO funds a little project. And really now programs are starting to look at how do you actually take these interventions to scale in country and improve the healthcare system and not just sort of stovepipe interventions in. And I think if that trend continues, that we'll see much more progress than what we have seen.
Paul?
I don't know where I'd put it, someplace between 10 and 20, but but the issue is the dynamic situation. And I think things are improving. I think we're better situated in many respects than we've been in my professional career at this point. But it's fragile, and it could be turned around quickly. And my greatest concern is that the interest, the engagement that we're seeing now from sectors that were never engaged will evaporate, either through inattention, lack of reward, or by the development of new challenges that are deemed more central.
Well, that's a great thought to close on. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panel for promoting
this discussion. Don't leave your chairs yet, please, because we do have some brief closing and celebratory comments that are coming from John Friedenrich. I'm sure I've not said his name right. But am I calling people to the stage? Yes, I'm seeing nods. John Friedenrich, Coit Chip Blacker, and Philip Pizzo. Pizzo, my apologies. John is a John's a leader at Stanford. That is clear. He's received his bachelor's degree from Stanford and LLD. He's been a leading lawyer and very involved with the Board of Trustees with Stanford, and he's currently chairman of the board of Packard Children's Hospital and of Stanford Hospital and Clinics. Coit Black is a director and senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, which is the parent organization of the Center for Health Policy. He also served during the Clinton administration in several distinguished roles in national security and a senior director for Russian, Ukrainian, Eurasian affairs at the NSC. And Philip Pizzo, am I saying it wrong? I apologize. He has served as dean of the Stanford School of Medicine, the parent organization for the Center of Primary Care and Outcomes Research, and also a very distinguished medical career. So I welcome you gentlemen for your celebratory comments.
Thank you very much. My name is Chip Blacker, and I'm privileged to direct the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford, and I can't resist a substantive observation. There is a terrific piece in the most recent issue of the Boston Review by Rosamond Naylor and Walter Falcon on the impact of the run-up in commodity prices in the area of food on the global economy, but also on those least capable of sustaining the burden. I recommend it to you in the most glowing of terms. I was delighted when Alan asked me to say a few words in connection with this, the 10th anniversary conference of the Center for Health Policy and PCOR. And I'm delighted because it allows me to do three things, to congratulate, to commend, and to thank. So let me add my voice to the chorus of congratulations that is poured over this podium over the course of the day to Alan and his team. And I do so from a slightly different perspective, as someone who has been involved in helping to create and to sustain these types of very ambitious inter-academic partnerships at Stanford for this is my 30th year. I can only tell you how hard it is to do. Yes, it's important. Yes, we all understand the value, but very few of us have either the time or the patience to kind of get down into the nitty-gritty and actually build these institutions. So my congratulations to Alan and his team. The best part of this is the first 10 years are the worst. They're the hardest. It doesn't get substantially easier, but it gets a little bit easier every time. Second is to commend not only the quality, but the reach and the impact of the research that is carried on under the auspices of these two extraordinary organizations. In the world in which I live, sometimes you get very high quality research but low impact. Sometimes you get middling quality research and very high impact. And it's very rare indeed when you get the very highest quality research also translating into policy outcomes that are high impact. I know best the work that goes on within CHP because it has more of an international orientation. And I can only tell you that the work that Doug Owens and his group have done on HIV and HIV prevention in Russia, and Paul and Paul's group on child health around the world, has just had an enormous and eye-opening impact. So thank you for that. And third, let me, in a more parochial sense, thank Alan and his team for their wonderful kind of collaborative sense with other units and centers, research clusters, within the Freeman Spogli Institute. They have very, very active collaborations underway with the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law in the area of health and governance, with the Center for International Security and Cooperation in the area of biosecurity and infectious disease, and with the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center on Asian Comparative Healthcare. It's a testament to the generosity of spirit that Paul referred to in his own remarks, and let me just underscore that. And let me conclude by offering my heartfelt and most special, most sincere thanks to Alan and to Kathy, to Doug and to Paul, to Grant and to Jay. And may we all gather again 10 years from now to celebrate the 20th.
I'll be brief because I think the dean and I are the only thing standing between you and cocktails and dinner, and that's not a position I would like to stay in very long. But I'd like to say I have been involved with Stanford over the years. I've been on and currently on both the Children's Board and the Adult Hospital Board, and have worked a lot with Phil at the Medical Center and at the school. So I really found today's activities very informative and made me very proud to be part of Stanford. I know a lot of you who are here today are not from Stanford, and I hope you've gotten some idea of some of the really wonderful people and some of the wonderful activities that we have here. On a scale of 1 to 100, I would give Alan and his group, and Coit and his group at the Freeman Spogli Institute, which has just been a sensational less than 10 years of activity for his institute. It's just really remarkable how highly regarded it is throughout the country and throughout academia. So it's very exciting for me to be here and see all of this pulled together. But on a 1 to 100, I would give the institute and the program that Alan runs an 80. And the only reason I wouldn't give them higher, I know they can do better in the future, so I don't want to put a cap on them. So when all of you come back in 10 years, I hope I'm back here with you. But thank you very much for having me. And now I'd like to introduce the dean of the medical school.
Thank you very much, John. I'd like to make two comments. The first is that I, too, want to thank Alan in particular for his extraordinary leadership. As we've all heard today in giving accolades for the acronyms that stand for the Center for Health Policy and Peace Corps, and have understood the important integration that has taken place between faculty really across the university, which is one of the wonderful things about Stanford, because it's able to bring people from different sectors of the university as well as wonderful individuals like John who help to support our activities, is that to bring that to real fruition, it requires an extraordinary leader. And Alan is really that. He is extraordinarily, wonderfully intelligent and talented, as you all know. But he's also able to bring people together to work in a common spirit and sense of purpose. And he emulates a spirit of really almost humility in how he approaches the world around him. And we heard that today in his presentation, where he was quick to give credit to others in terms of the wisdom that they might bring. But I think I would add that it really is really his wisdom that has really brought us to this point in time, to this celebration today. He's a world-class investigator, renowned around the world for his contributions. And because of that, he's assembled a world-class group of people that really have made this so successful. Now, the second is, I think that we have today really learned a lot, at least I have, about the various components that are important in terms of thinking about healthcare in the future. And it's led me to want to add another acronym to those that are on the podium just in front of me, because I think it's clear that Stanford and certainly the medical school stands for innovation and technology. That's something that we do well and seek to do well, and we believe that that will make a difference when directly applied to the right populations to make a fundamental difference in how healthcare is delivered, and hopefully in a less expensive way. But I also think that we could, to the IT part of that, add two other letters, D and E. That creates the acronym. So it's diet, innovation, exercise, and technology. And of course, Alan speaks to that as well, because Alan and I share a number of things together, but one is a pathological need to run multiple marathons during the course of a year, and that requires not simply saying the words or running the lines, but modeling it in terms of real behavior. So as we go forward, perhaps we should change our name to the Stanford School of Diet, or at least epitomize those values as very important to our future. So thank you very much, Alan, for all that you've done and for the colleagues that you've assembled and for this 10th anniversary celebration. And now I think I call on you for final comments.
Well, thank you, Phil. After those comments, I sort of feel like I shouldn't say anything. But I am compelled to say something. And I'm not going to take long. And there are a number of people to thank both for what our centers have accomplished over the years and for today's event. But about what we've accomplished over the years, Chip said he knows how hard it is to create new interdisciplinary centers. But I have to disagree with him a little bit. We started from scratch. That is, there was the university's resources, but I was able to handpick all the people, including the faculty that we started with. And any of you who's been through an experience like that knows that there are definitely practical difficulties and challenges, but it is far, far easier than to build something new with a lot that already exists that you have to work around. And we were really fortunate that way, and the first thing I did was to ask Kathy McDonald and Sarah Singer, who are both here, to work with me in developing the two centers, each as executive director of one of the centers. And subsequently, when Sarah left, Kathy took over both of their responsibilities, in essence. And our faculty also have been terrific. And it just wouldn't have been possible to get such a great group had we had to start with existing people and resources and so on, and we've just been extraordinarily fortunate that way. Another way in which we've been extraordinarily fortunate, it is 10 years, and you may be surprised to hear, for those of you who aren't from academia, that actually things do change in academia, even if it seems that it's at a glacial pace. And all of the leadership that had been in place when the centers were created have moved on to other roles. And so I actually have three bosses. Two of them are up here, Chip Blacker and Phil Piso, and the third is Ralph Horowitz, the chair of the Department of Medicine. And let me tell you something. You may know this from your own experience, but it's one thing to have enthusiastic support from somebody who played a role in the creation of an institution of any kind, and it's another to have the enthusiastic support of somebody who stepped in to a role. where they have to support something that they may not have felt any strong attachment to. And we have had the remarkable good fortune of having leadership that has every step of the way been extremely supportive of our activities, answered every request we've ever made positively and with great enthusiasm, and I believe have taken deep, deep interest in what we do. And that it's actually the fact that they seem to really be engaged and respect what we do that means the most to us. And I think you saw that today in Chip and Phil's comments, and Ralph is the same way. So to have that kind of ongoing support in academia, at least, is just remarkable, and we're very grateful for that. So could you please join me in thanking you. Now, we had a lot of other help with today's event, and I want to first thank our sponsors who've been extraordinarily generous. And incidentally, the sponsors have helped us in many ways other than financially over the years. And so my words can't be adequate to thank them, but let me just mention them: the California Healthcare Foundation, Gilead, Prolegen, the Stanford Center on Longevity, Exelixis, Genentech, and Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. We've also had, of course, just tremendous help from our advisor committee. I won't name them all. They're in your program, but I may embarrass them a little bit by saying this, but there are two people in particular who I pestered with questions all along, have been enormously helpful, Rob Chess and Leighton Reed, tremendously helpful in helping us conceptualize this event and carry it out. We've also benefited greatly from the assistance of OAR associates. Three of the people are here now, Richard Galua, Danielle Friedman, and Amanda Pape. Let me just say that we have a lot of experience running meetings, that is, seminars that involve 30 or 40 people. There's a few more moving parts in an event like this, and the assistance of OAR associates has been just invaluable in making sure things went well. And within Freeman Spogli Institute, we've had the help of Mary Ellen Horvath, Neil Pienick, and Judith Paulus. And I want to thank our speakers as well. And I won't thank them all individually, but I think you'll agree with me. It has been an utterly spectacular group of people, great comments and great discussion. And above all else, Matt Miller, whose moderation has been nothing short of extraordinary. We knew we were getting a professional, but the combination of just great moderator skills and substantive insights is just spectacular. So thank you to the speakers. And finally, as I said, there are a lot of moving parts. We had a lot of help from OAR associates, and our staff at CHPP Corps have spent actually months preparing for this event, and the fact that I hope you haven't seen any glitches reflects their preparation. Kathy McDonald is really the person who most strongly pushed for having this event. I think she might have even thought of it, and there have been times when we didn't know whether to praise her or to blame her, but today we definitely feel like praising her. She's really kept spirits up through through a lot of work, and all of our staff have other jobs that they have to do in addition to preparing for this, and they did a remarkable job. Nancy Lonhart, our administrator, I think is in the back of the room here somewhere, played a tremendous role in preparing for this event. And there are four people in particular who took this under their wings and just spent an enormous amount of time making sure that everything would be just perfect: Mary Herta, Kristen Cox, Melissa Miller, and Celeste Brown. Would you please join me in thanking them? And there are many, many more people who I haven't thanked individually, our administrative team and other people throughout the university and outside. And I hope you won't take my omission of your names as a slight, but I do think that I'm standing behind all of you and the resveratrol and other snacks that are out in the reception area. But let me just add that I am really grateful to the audience, to all of you who have taken the time out of your busy days. We know who's here pretty much, and we know how busy you are. Most of you could have been up on the podium speaking today, and many of you who wouldn't be on the podium today, like our trainees, would probably fill that role very well in another few years. So it means a lot to us to have you share in our celebration, and I thank you for joining us. So please come out.